From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll look at the history of the Ghost Army, a unit of soldiers in World War II, meant to deceive the Nazis. Then we'll learn about the history of the Milwaukee Soldiers' Home and how it helped generations of veterans.
This is a building that is made with the very sort of marrow of who we are. It's a beautiful Gothic tower built with cream city brick made from clay from the Menominee Valley. I mean, it's very much of us.
Plus, we'll learn about a unique World War II era program that put family pets on the front lines.
They really reached out to folks on the home front, including children, and this included them asking for family pets to be donated to service in the war.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. During World War II, the Allies used everything at their disposal to defeat the Axis powers, including a lot of trickery. One of the best examples, the Ghost Army units, groups of soldiers armed with little more than inflatable weaponry and sound machines. The work of these units was classified for decades after the war, and former soldiers had to keep their work a secret, like Al Albrecht, one of the soldiers in the Ghost Army, whose family knew little about his time at war until his work was declassified in the mid-1990s. Before his passing, Albrecht shared his story with groups around the nation. Now his story lives on through his daughter, Karen Skiba, who wrote about the Ghost Army in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. She joins me now to share more about her father's work. Karen, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Well, thank you for inviting me. My dad was so proud to have been part of the extraordinary Ghost Army unit, and it's really a privilege to share their story with you today.
Before your dad's work was declassified, because it had been a classified operation, what had he told you about his time in the war?
Well, that's the funny thing. He didn't talk much about it, and there were clues everywhere in our house. We didn't really ask about it, and he didn't talk about it a lot. So it was kind of funny that we didn't know until 50 years later. But we were really shocked to find out that he was part of this special unit called the Ghost Army.
Yeah, so what was that like? Because it seems as though part of why your father probably didn't talk much about it was that it had been classified information, but then, of course, it became declassified.
Right. He wasn't even allowed to tell his wife, so my mom didn't even know about his service. I don't know how he could keep such a good secret for so many years. Yeah, it wasn't until 50 years after the war that it was declassified, and we didn't learn about it until he started organizing these reunions, and then he would tell us it's for the Ghost Army. I said, well, what is that? And then he would explain what the Ghost Army was, that it was a deception unit meant to mislead the army, and they used inflatable tanks, sound effects, and other clever tactics that were top secret. And then he started doing presentations at schools and community events, and I helped him with that because I was really good in my field. I'm good with PowerPoint and things like that. So I would go to a lot of his events, and then I would hear about these stories. And I said, this is my dad? I was really surprised at all the things that he did in the army. And he also then was interviewed for a Ghost Army documentary, and he was interviewed for some books and all of that. And that's when I started to learn more. But he wasn't a person who told us a lot. One time he sat us down for a family presentation, and he gave our family a little slideshow presentation and shared what he all did. And it was really interesting to hear his perspective, and he shared some personal stories.
One of the things I found really interesting in your father's description of how it all worked, I was able to listen to a fair bit of his talk on this, was that they weren't really armed. Here's a clip of your dad, Al, talking about his experience.
Where else did you have a unit that had rubber tanks, rubber trucks, rubber aircraft, and false sound equipment? I think we were very unique, yes. The Ghost Army was very different. We had very few weapons. In fact, I would say not very defensive weapons, but we were mainly combat deception people.
Listening to that, you think to yourself, these were people who were deployed on a battlefield in the middle of a huge scale war. What were they armed with? What were the tools that they had to fight, really?
Well, as he said, he didn't have a lot of weapons. They had a few guns. But the one thing that he told me that scared me is that they had to keep explosives under the seats of their half-track because in case they were found out, because they were secret, they weren't supposed to be, you know, have all these inflatable things and people would have found that out. So he was given the orders that if they saw them, they would have to blow up everything. Luckily, that never happened. And obviously, he came back from the war. There were four men, though, that did die carrying out their missions. And my dad was injured as well because he drove a half-track. He was always the first one who drove because he had really good eyesight. And he hit a tree and he knocked out all his front teeth. But, yeah, they didn't have a lot of weapons. And they just their goal was to get out of there as fast as they could and not be detected. And that's all I did.
Now, when I was thinking about, you know, what is the purpose of this? It takes you a moment to think, okay, well, you know, I guess maybe you're kind of holding up some of their resources. And then, again, I did listen to a bit of what your dad had to say on the subject. This is a bit of a longer clip, but I think worth listening to.
The combat deception was in such a way that it was total, if you can picture that. It had to be sonic. That's what I drove. I drove a half-track. Back of my half-track, I tell my children, was the biggest boombox you ever saw. But it played sounds of tanks and activity. And it was recorded on a wire, and then we would play this to the Germans, probably in artillery position, which was a half mile or a mile away. They would then recognize that there was action, and they would send over an aircraft, a light aircraft. And they would see all these tanks, and from the air, this really looked real. Then they would bombard, fortunately, over us to the 603rd, puncture the rubber tanks, and they had to be repaired continuously. They would be putting together defense, and there we would see tanks and other Army equipment being put together to defend themselves. In the meantime, the real action was taking place someplace else. The real action of our group was surrounding them. And in the meantime, after this was all done, our part of it was all done, and this is the part I liked, that's why we called the Ghost Army, we could deflate all the rubber tanks and disappear. In about 2 hours, we were gone.
Listening to that, you think, okay, all right, that's why they would use this. But I have to imagine being in that situation was so perilous.
It was. He did say, one of his later quotes is, they were scared. They didn't know if they were going to come back alive or not because some of their actions took place only a mile away. Can you imagine that? I just couldn't. I always just told my husband on the way here that I wish I could have been there to see this. I just couldn't imagine them being so close to the enemy and some of the other things that they did. And we're just grateful that he came back and only, as I mentioned, only four men did die. So most of them did come back. So they did, obviously, a really great job in their deceptions.
One of the things that you've brought in here, or some of the things, I should say, are a variety of patches. Of course,
right.
Your father wasn't, he was in a kind of, I don't want to call it a fake unit, but he was in a unit that I would imagine, being as surreptitious as it was, didn't necessarily have outward symbols. So what do these badges really mean?
Well, they're all fake badges. And this was one of the stories that he told me that I was most surprised about. They would pretend to be officers of different units. So my dad and the other men would sew these patches, and then they would go to the local cafes and bars and, you know, talk it up, pretend that they were going to be going somewhere else. And then there were spies, German spies, that were listening into them and hear, oh, they're going to be going over there. We better go there. So they would be spies. And that, to me, was just amazing. Maybe that's how he got all of his great skills as a salesman, lying. I don't know. But but he was a very persuasive speaker that helped him in his future career as a salesperson. But I'm sure my mom was really surprised because he never used those sewing skills ever again.
How effective was the Ghost Army at really using up the resources of the German army and distracting them away from what was the real intent of the army? How effective were they?
Well, they were extremely effective. They sometimes could actually make themselves look like, they would also join with other groups sometimes. Like they could make themselves look like there were 40,000 of them when there were only 1,100 of them. So they would use fake blow-up tanks. They would use even fake planes. I even saw pictures of blow-up soldiers. It was amazing. So from the sky, they looked like a real unit, and they did have people attack them, and they did. They had many stories of the Allies that said that they didn't come over to attack us because they were over by you, trying to attack you, and you were able to distract them. And because of that, you saved many American and German lives.
When you think about the legacy of the Ghost Army, what does that look like to you?
Well, my dad's most proud whenever I heard him talk about this is the lives that he saved. It so happens that our heritage is heavily German. So it was really important to him to save lives from the German side, the Allied side. He wanted to save as many lives as possible and not take lives. He never had to shoot or kill anyone. That's what he kept talking to me about the most, is how he was able to save people. In fact, one of the quotes, you might have it there, that was shared in the documentary as, "War is meant to shoot people and kill people, and we saved people." That's what made me very proud. So to me, that one quote summarizes the legacy of the Ghost Army.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm proud of my dad's service, and thank you so much for sharing that with your listeners.
Karen Skiba is a teaching and learning specialist at UW-Madison, and her piece on the Ghost Army units in World War II was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. You can find more of our conversations about Milwaukee Magazine articles at WUWM.com.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Ayan Silver. Today, we asked J.R. Ross to explain the presidential election results. He's editor of WizPolitics.com. Welcome, J.R. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so you told Lake Effect's Joy Powers right after the election that a lot of Trump's victory in the state and the country comes down to the idea that people are unhappy with the direction of the country and thought Trump would be better for the economy. But on the flip side, more people voted for Harris than only two presidential candidates in Wisconsin history. That's Obama in 2008 and Donald Trump in 2024. Do you know anything else at this point about how this happened?
Oh, sure. I mean, the signs were there. We could see them. People are unhappy about the economy, the direction of the country. Kamala Harris promised change but could not articulate how she'd be a change agent compared to Joe Biden. In fact, there was a very effective ad that Trump ran that, which she was asked, was done differently than Biden, and she said, "I couldn't think of anything." That doesn't help you when in a tough environment. And let's be honest, she faced a difficult task, 107-day campaign. The incumbent that she was tied to is very unpopular, and all the environmental issues that she faced with the economy and immigration, all these things, I'm not sure anybody could have won that race. Everything was in Trump's favor, if you think about it, from that big picture of how people feel. And I think we talked before about, I was watching for, was something going to break in this race? Was something going to really move in the end that would show us what was going on? And we would pretty much know. We'd go, oh, of course is what happened. Well, just seeing Trump win, of course it was going to happen when people go, I'm not happy with what's going on in this country. I'm not happy paying so much for my kids' shoes or when I'm paying the grocery store. Yes, inflation is down. Yes, there are good things with the unemployment rate, but people still feel that they are not doing well. When people feel unhappy, they take it out, party in power in the White House, and they happen to be Democrats, and Kamala Harris is a Democrat. It's not rocket science. Granted, there are things that, you know, this postmortem, you're going to hear all kinds of teeth gnashing by Democrats about what they did wrong, and Republicans pound their chests about how they've, you know, found this great secret. In the end, it's about the economy and how people feel. And those working class voters who went to Republicans, will they stay there or will they swing back or stay home in coming elections if they don't feel as inspired as they were by Donald Trump.
You know, when it comes to Milwaukee, I mean, that's Wisconsin's largest metro area. There was a shift rightward among almost all large metro areas in the country. Were you seeing that as well?
Yeah. Yeah, the interesting thing is that the wow counties, you know, Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington, actually did worse for Trump. Now, that is the continued erosion of the suburban vote for Republicans that we've been seeing for 8 straight years now. I'll tell you, on election night, you know, I knew Milwaukee was going to be late because of Central Count and the issues that it had with starting over in 31,000 ballots. So I had in my mind Dane and Waukesha counties as key kind of indicators of what was going to go on, watching those counties to see what came in. And as I'm watching Waukesha kind of update its numbers and Trump is dropping, not just below 60%, but below 59%, I'm like, how do you win statewide as a Republican below 59%? I've never seen that before for a Republican or a conservative candidate in a statewide race in Wisconsin. He has created a new path. It's simply you can, or, you know, not do so well in those counties, those suburban counties, if you cut into the Democratic advantage place like Dane County, where Kamala Harris is below 75%, and have a surge in rural areas, which he had. The question is, can any other Republican replicate that formula? Ron Johnson, when he won re-election 2 years ago, he did better in Waukesha County than Trump did. He survived by a point. I'm not sure any other Republican can do less than 59% in Waukesha County and still win statewide. So Republicans, their challenge is, how do you bump that number up in those wow counties and maintain the engagement of these rural voters who came out for Trump? It's going to be fascinating to watch in the Supreme Court race this spring and the midterm elections of 2026 if they can do it. If they can, that's a pretty potent combination. But if they can't, that's a problem, because the more you turn suburban voters, highly educated, upper middle class voters, you know, and up the scale economically, they turn out every election, not just in midterms, but in special elections, spring elections, they're always there. That gives Democrats an advantage if they hold those folks in those non-presidential years. So it's an interesting switch from when I started 25 years ago, and Republicans always had the advantage, seemed like, in midterm elections or special elections, because their voters were those suburban folks who turn out all the time.
There's so much to unpack there. I wanted to ask you, you know, about Republicans' efforts in places like Milwaukee and Dane County, which you've mentioned. They had an effort called Lose by Less, and the idea was to compete in these heavily Democratic Milwaukee and Dane counties, having targeted outreach to voters who might be open to their message in these very blue counties. I want to know, did Republicans do this around the country? And, well, first let's start with, how did it shake out numbers-wise in Wisconsin?
So the thing is, for this wave election that we had, we basically saw a switch of about 30-some thousand votes. Trump lost in 2020 by less than 21,000. He won in 2024 in Wisconsin by less than 30. So we're not talking a huge, massive shift of people in this state. We are still on the razor's edge. It's also worth noting that the red wave we saw around the country crashed a little bit softer here than elsewhere. Let's just look at Michigan and Pennsylvania. If you had told me a year ago that Wisconsin would vote more to the left than Michigan, Pennsylvania, if it happened 4 years ago, where they both went bigger for Biden than Wisconsin, I thought, well, that'd be odd. How's that going to happen? And I don't know Michigan or Pennsylvania as well as I do Wisconsin, so I'm not going to guess what happened there. But what I can tell you is, in Wisconsin, Democrats have built a pretty good ground game. And that ground game is not going to win you an election when the environment is against you like it was this fall. But it can dampen some of a wave, like it looks like it did. For Republicans, though, they had some successes in places like the UW-Madison campus, for example. Turning Point USA, a conservative group, really kind of big fans of Donald Trump. They targeted young voters, especially males, college campuses. That looks like it made a difference in a place like Madison. Helped keep Harris below 75%. Now, will those first-time young male voters turn out for a Supreme Court race? You know, people I talk to have their doubts. They're not known as the most reliable voters for Supreme Court races. Also, midterm elections, will they turn out in 2026 for the GOP nominee for governor, who's not Donald Trump? Maybe, but I wouldn't bank on them. My conversations are people, Republicans, who are worried, how do we keep those folks engaged? If they can do it, awesome for them. they have a nice coalition if they can. But if they can't, then what happens? And especially when the party in power in the White House almost always has a difficult midterm election. The exceptions have been last 30 years, 2022 with Democrats and Dobbs' decision, 2002, the post-9/11 election, and 1998 when the Bill Clinton impeachment hung over everything. Otherwise, I can go back and go wave, wave, wave in most midterm elections in this country.
You're tuned into Capitol Notes. I'm WEWM's Maayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. Okay, so you've been talking a little bit about Dane County with the University of Madison, the state capital, a lot of state employees, a lot of students. Milwaukee is a bit of a different animal. Can you tell me, you know, with this lose by less effort that Milwaukee had been making with Milwaukee with urban voters, what are you seeing there, or are you seeing it as simply part of a red wave or a Trump wave? I mean, in terms of the ground game.
I have not gone super deep in the Milwaukee ward by ward numbers. Been a little tired this week, not going to lie. But it does look like the Democratic margin of victory in, I think, 53 Hispanic wards fell like 10 points or something like that. John Johnson is a researcher at Marquette Law School, research fellow, I should say. And he looked at those black wards in Milwaukee, slipped by like 2 points. So we didn't see a huge erosion, at least from John's research, among black voters in Milwaukee. But in Hispanic voters, definitely a change. Now, we saw that nationally. Exit polls showed Trump doing well with Hispanic voters, that Harris really kind of underperformed compared to Biden. So something is there. And what it suggests is, once again, people sometimes, wrongly, I would argue, lump all voters of a certain block as, oh, they're all the same. They're not. You know, and economic concerns drive things for a lot of people, regardless of your background, whether you want to talk race, class, zip code, you know, on down the line. It seems like there was definitely an economic worry among a lot of voters, and that cuts across all lines, all demographics.
I think Republican strategist Bill McCoshin told me that it's fairly rare. I mean, it seems intuitive for Republicans to try to compete in the counties with the two largest populations and to try to cut their margins there and get more votes there. But he seemed to say that not a lot of, you know, Republican candidates have tried to do that in the state, save maybe like Tommy Thompson and now Trump. What can you tell me about that?
Oh, one of my favorite stats in Wisconsin politics. Three counties account for majority, like 45% of the primary vote for Democrats in the typical statewide primary. Milwaukee and Dane, obviously. The third, Waukesha County. Now, that might seem kind of like odd. This is like a red county, Waukesha, you know, the heartbeat of the GOP for years. But it's a big county. There are lots of Democrats there. Likewise, there are lots of Republicans in Milwaukee County and in Dane County. Trump stopped in Dane County in Wanakee as part of his visits around the state. He was in Milwaukee, obviously, in the closing days of the race. They competed there. Now the question is, can anybody else compete the way he did in Dane County? I haven't seen it, but you can bet Republicans took notes of how he did and are thinking, okay, how do we replicate this going forward?
And I want to ask you about the low propensity voters. These are people that don't vote often, but who the parties and campaigns think are open to their message. Sometimes these people have been labeled like zeros and ones in a voter file. That's the information that each campaign keeps on each potential voter. What do you know about how Republicans were able to go after this type of voter in Wisconsin? And did it work?
Looking at all 72 counties, Trump got a bigger share of the vote in all of them but like four or five. Three are the wow counties. Another one is Door County, which has been like a bellwether. That went for Harris and went for Biden last time. But he improved pretty much everywhere. Urban, rural, not suburban, obviously, with the Milwaukee suburbs, of course, but everywhere else he did. So is that just because of the targeting? Is that because of the environment? Is that because of Trump himself? You know, we'll be diving this for years and trying to pick apart what happened, but it is clear that Trump tapped into a concern people have about the direction of the country, and he got more votes in Wisconsin, likely because of it.
And so you can't necessarily attribute it to, like, Republicans' shift in tactics or their ground game or anything.
Well, you know, Republicans, in talking to people the course of this fall, they felt like the Republican ground game wasn't as strong, it was more fractured than Democrats. Now, when you win, it papers over everything. It cures all ills, no matter what happens. When you win, you did everything right. Again, if you dive into the numbers a little bit, the wave crashed a little bit lighter here than other places. Why is that? Is that because the Democrats had a better ground game? You know, people think so, maybe. But you can't deny that, like, Turning Point USA targeting college kids probably helped. Groups like Americans for Prosperity probably helped going out and targeting legislative races. Like, they're, you know, victory has a thousand fathers. Loss, only one, right? Old saying in politics. So there are lots of people contributed. But again, the environment to me, my conversations, the number one takeaway is it was the economy. That's what drove everything. And all these groups that did turn out, all the messaging, it all rode that wave of people unhappy about the economy and what's going on in this country.
Thanks for the political analysis, JR, and thanks for joining me on Capital Notes.
Anytime.
Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. During World War II, everyday citizens were asked to sacrifice a lot. In some cases, that included their family pets. Later in the show, we'll learn about the War Dog Program and a Wisconsin pup who was deployed to the Pacific Theater. But first, we'll tell you about the history of the Milwaukee Soldiers' Home. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Looking west over the city of Milwaukee near the Brewers Stadium, you may have seen a Victorian turret rising above a thicket of trees. If you move closer, you'll find a grand home, more than a century old, surrounded by a complex of historic buildings all created with a singular goal: helping America's veterans. It's the Milwaukee Soldiers' Home. And since it was created in the mid-1800s, it's helped generations of veterans. A film from Milwaukee PBS explores that history and how it continues to help veterans today. Marianne Lazarski and Scotty Lee Myers were the producers behind the documentary called A Hallowed Home for Heroes. They join me to talk about the mission of the Soldiers' Home. The Milwaukee Soldiers' Home has become a pretty iconic part of the skyline, specifically near the Brewers Stadium. Why was the Soldiers' Home first created?
Well, it was created actually by a group of women who were taking care of soldiers during the Civil War era in makeshift temporary storefronts. And just to kind of briefly tell you, they were set on trying to figure out a permanent place for the soldiers to come and rest and heal from their wounds and sicknesses. And so they're the ones who really were the founders of the Soldiers' Home. And there was a fair that was involved, and they raised a ton of money, $110,000. And, you know, back then that was a lot of money. And their business husbands decided to go to Washington and tell President Lincoln that he should build the first soldiers' home here in Milwaukee. And that was at the same time that the president had signed legislation to create a national system of soldiers' homes. But these women, they were smart women, and they were gung-ho about, hey, we're going to get this done. And so, you know, that's kind of how it all started.
Yeah, the origin of the VA system as we know it today, we see that big building, the Clement J. Zablocki VA Medical Center on the south side of Milwaukee. That whole system, the story starts in Milwaukee with, as Marianne said, these founding women. And sometimes I think we get this impression when we hear about, you know, the mid-19th century women creating this, but they weren't just sort of like having tea parties and raising money. These were like real political actors of that time with strong project management sense, with great business acumen. They got things done. And, you know, this story also coincides with President Abraham Lincoln's last legislative act, one of his last legislative acts before he was assassinated. And essentially, he called on Congress in his second inaugural address to build a national system of homes to take care of veterans as they return from the battlegrounds.
Well, this comes around at a really interesting time, I think, both in our nation's history, but also kind of the history of the world. We're in a situation where, for the first time, soldiers are in larger numbers surviving their injuries. These are people who are not necessarily dying on the battlefield. They aren't dying in these battlefield-side hospitals, but they are able to come home. But their lives are forever changed by their time at war. What were the initial years of this space like as they're kind of figuring out what this system is going to be?
So there was a strong patriotic sense that we need to care for these men who are returning home from battle. And so the mass efforts that were undertaken, I mean, every sort of parish and town and corner of the city, there was organizing happening. People were doing, you know, collections of money, collections of clothing, of food, of lint that would help with wounds. So in the beginning, it really was an incredible all-hands-on-deck effort. But it also sort of, I mean, these were men who were scarred and who had amputations and injuries from war. And sometimes they suffered. There's quite a bit of documentation about drinking and alcoholism on campus. So like any sort of population, there was, you know, struggles as well.
Like Scotty said, you know, patriotism was very strong. But even today, there are veterans from, you know, the Iraq War, Afghanistan, those who would have otherwise been homeless at least have an option, you know, if they qualify to be at Milwaukee Soldiers Home. So, you know, and this is, and the future is important because sadly, there will probably be other wars. We always hope that there aren't. But there will always be a place for veterans who are in need of some place to live.
And the veterans who live in Old Main and on campus right now, they are really being provided by a couple agencies on campus with wraparound services, whether it's employment help, financial literacy, a connection to both mental and physical health. So those wraparound services exist today to veterans who are living at the Milwaukee Soldiers Home.
And that makes Milwaukee and Milwaukee Soldiers Home unique.
Yeah.
That everything is kind of right there for those veterans.
Well, and this is something that is, I was about to say new, but relatively new, in part because although the Soldiers Home is very old, things changed over the decades at the space itself. What has that evolution been like in the space? Because for a time it was closed.
Yeah, it was closed for nearly 30 years, and obviously a lot of deterioration happened. But one of the main project manager from the Alexander Company, who oversaw the restoration of six buildings there, and they reopened in 2021, you know, their intent was to raise the money to restore these buildings because they knew it was very important. And you know, they're hoping to do the same with three other buildings there on the campus, which is the theater, the chapel, and what's called the governor's mansion. So remember, Soldiers Home was like a village district in and of itself and had its own zip code, but it also had a governor, so to speak, who oversaw the district. And so those other three buildings hopefully will be restored very soon because the veterans would like that to happen. People in this community would like to see that happen. And the restoration that happened with the original six buildings, it's really impressive, especially with Old Main. When you look at the photographs and the images of the deterioration and then you see how it's been transformed, the veterans who live there are just, they're in awe. You know, as they told us, if you're a veteran dealing with some trauma or in crisis and you have no place to go, this is, as they put it, a great deal. So yeah. We're fortunate to have this here in our own backyard.
And the existence of this place was called into question in the past as well. In 1915, 16, 1917, as Civil War veterans were sort of aging and dying and their numbers were dwindling at Old Main and on campus there, folks weren't really sure if, like, there was a need for this place anymore. There was a city official who said, should we close this place down and just make it, like, a big park for the public? And then came World War I and things to follow, and then you had sort of a new generation of veterans moving into the home. 1989, fast forward a bit, that is when the VA officially put locks on the doors. Old Main was too old to tear down, but also too decrepit to let people live there anymore. And so it just sat there vacant. Paint was peeling from the walls. A New York Times article referred to it as Spanish moss, almost. I mean, it was just a dire situation. And then the roof collapsed. And then when the roof collapsed, it really galvanized the community to come together and say, look, this is a jewel in our community with a ton of history. It's a beautiful, we need to preserve this place. And that's really when things kicked off. The Milwaukee Soldiers Home was, we all love to hate listicles, but it was named one of the 11 most endangered National Historic Landmarks in the country. And really a revitalization effort was put into place after that.
So as we look at the documentary itself, how do you explore this history? Because we're talking about a lot of time. What is it, 130 years?
There's 140? There's a ton of history. And, you know, you can't cover every single little detail, but yet important detail. We tried to tell this story through a family, actually, who grew up there because their dad was a chaplain for the VA and he was an Army colonel. And they helped walked us through the journey of the soldiers' home by coming back and having them reflect on some of their memories. Their parents are both buried at Wood. And they talk about primarily their teenage years of what it was like to live in old Building 11, which was the fire engine house at the time. Before they moved in there, and they talk about some of their memories and soldiers walking back and forth on the side of their house, and they never used the back door to only to take out the garbage because there was always, you know, soldiers walking around, and people didn't know where they lived. You know, their friends were like, "You live where?" So they had a very sweet story to tell, and they too are very passionate about the soldiers' home and what it represents and who it serves. And so they were very gracious and helping, and they wanted to help us tell this story. But, you know, we also had to talk about the women founders because that's really important. And, of course, you have to talk to veterans because that's who this place impacts and serves. And we had to talk to historians, right, and preservationists. We spent about a year working on this project, and, you know, the first thing you do is research, right? And I don't know how many documents we went through, and Scotty reading a number of books and going over to the UWM archives, and just to try to figure out and get a sense of, okay, you know, what really needs to be covered in the time that we have. So, again, this is not a 10-part documentary, right? And so we had to be a little bit selective, but I think we covered the main points. So people who didn't know anything about the Soldiers' Home, which is why we did this in the first place, because, you know, we were tired of hearing people saying, you know, well, what's that building? You know, you go to the Brewer game. Hey, do you know what that is? And it looks like a haunted house, but no. And then you tell them and they're like, oh, really? And so I think this documentary is educational for those people who don't know anything about it. And also, I think it's also a very, I don't know, it just hits the heart, I think, when those people who do know about it, they can kind of reflect and think back to maybe some of the stories that they heard, maybe from parents or great-grandparents. It just kind of solidifies the uniqueness and the importance of this place that we have in Milwaukee.
And you can't do a documentary about a historic Milwaukee institution without chatting with John Gerda, who is featured in this documentary. And right at the top of the doc, he says, you know, the Milwaukee Soldiers Home, Old Main, is the most visible and least recognized building probably in the whole city of Milwaukee. And I think that's true. We don't know enough about this place. I mean, this is a building that is made with the very sort of like marrow of who we are. It's a beautiful Gothic tower built with cream city brick made from clay from the Menominee Valley. I mean, it's very much of us. And so we are honored and proud to share a little bit of its story.
And I also think people aren't going to realize until they watch the documentary that it's not just Old Main that represents Milwaukee Soldiers Home. There's a lot more to that campus, and they might be surprised.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Scotty, Marianne, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Always happy to talk to you, Joy.
Thanks, Joy. I appreciate it.
Marianne Lazarski and Scotty Lee Myers are producers at Milwaukee PBS and the team behind its new documentary, A Hallowed Home for Heroes. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn about a Wisconsin pet turned World War II veteran and a new children's book all about his life. That's next on Lake Effect. On 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. During World War II, American families were asked to make a lot of sacrifices. Americans rationed everything from food and clothing to gas and firewood. Some families were even asked to donate their pets to the war effort for the Dogs for Defense program. The military deployed family pets to the front lines to help soldiers on the battlefield, including a little dog named Brownie from King, Wisconsin. His life story is now the subject of a children's book, called Brownie the War Dog, written by Kelly Nelson. She joins me to talk about it and the history of war dogs. Kelly, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
One of the most fascinating things about this book is this little-known program it discusses, where Americans were encouraged to enlist their pets. Can you tell us a bit about it?
I'd be glad to. So the Dogs for Defense program was very unique. It was a civilian-based program that was started by dog enthusiasts. And they started to think that maybe that there was a skill set with dogs, and especially in the obedience world and things that they thought might marry well with the military and what they could use the dogs for as far as war use. So it was a very unique time. And they really reached out to folks on the home front, including children. And this included them asking for family pets to be donated to service in the war. And there were regional recruiters. There was one in Milwaukee that we know of. And at that time, this was new. This was a new use for World War II. So they relied on recruiting the family pets.
Now, I was a bit familiar with the Army and the Navy using cats, you know, for pest control and that kind of thing on ships and in storage facilities, but I was less aware of exactly what dogs were being enlisted to do. What were the kinds of jobs that a dog would perform during the war?
Sure. So there was a variety of tasks that they had really enlisted them for. Many were sentry dogs, which Brownie was a sentry dog, basically a guard dog. And it was guarding artillery. It was guarding the men. A handler was assigned, and that individual handler exclusively handled the war dog. And it was not a pet anymore. It was trained to be an attack dog. And even the other soldiers didn't get close. It was something that was, it was a tool. And it was a tool that was very much used for protection. Other dogs that were more like a husky and those kind of breeds, Malamutes, they were used for pulling sleds in different regions. Some dogs were used as messenger dogs to relay messages to soldiers. So a variety of uses. And they did have to have specific height requirements, weight requirements. These were not jobs that were suited for small dogs. They had to have some girth to them.
Do we know about how many dogs ended up serving in World War II for the U.S. Army?
The U.S. Military in general had asked for about 200,000. That was what their goal was. They wanted purebreds. But at that time in our country, there were not a lot of purebreds. And so they had to widen their net as far as reaching out to crossbreeds and things, shepherd mixes, Dobermans, but about 20,000 dogs were donated, with about 10,000 of those making the cut. Many of the dogs were afraid of noises, and that seemed to be the biggest problem, that the dogs were put in situations where they just shut down because of the noises. So they became very particular as far as who they approved to be in the War Dog program, and much of it was based, again, on the size, but also their ability to withstand the noises.
Sure. A lot of noise during war, I would imagine, and a lot of different requirements as far as temperament, as far as ability to do the job, as you say. What made a dog like Brownie a good candidate for the war?
I think really the trainability. The youth, they had to be young dogs. They had to be trainable. The main thing being that they had to be quiet. Even in, if you follow any dog obedience, as you get into the upper ranks, a lot of the dog training is done with hand signals. And these dogs had to learn to be quiet. These dogs really had to learn to watch their handlers because everything was given with either hand signals or by body language. And they had to learn to be very quiet. So really, I think just the willingness and trainability was the main thing as far as the success of the dogs.
So for Brownie, what was that journey like from being a house pet into being on the front lines with all of the other soldiers?
Right. So he was sent from Waupaca, Wisconsin. He was sent to the Fort Robinson Dog Receiving and Training Center out in Nebraska. And that's where veterinarians, they did, you know, they had an initial physical to make sure he passed physical requirements. And then that's when intense training started. And a big part of that was assigning a handler, having that handler be the exclusive person to feed him, groom him, train him. And it was a very intense training process that they needed to go through. And again, much of it being for the dog to learn to be quiet and really follow and watch his handler so that they were ready to be shipped over to the Pacific Theater in Brownie's case in order to do the job to keep his handler safe and his unit safe.
Now, once he was out there, what was Brownie doing?
So he was a sentry dog. So he, a variety of tasks. It was really to be a protector for his handler, for his unit. In any capacity, he was always being asked to sniff out the enemy. And these were in very, very intense circumstances. The Pacific Theater really refers to the islands. There was a lot of battling that was going on where they had to hop from island to island. And this also included the monsoon season in more of the spring and June time of the year. And Brownie was there for about a year and a half, so he would have withstood this where it just rained constantly. And these were jungles, so just really awful conditions. Sometimes it was shoulder deep in water that the dogs had to wade through, so really, really miserable circumstances. But he did his job and he did it well.
Now, of course, World War II had many casualties, and I was surprised to learn that a little dog like Brownie was able to survive the war. He came back, but like many veterans, he had changed quite a bit. How did Brownie live out the rest of his days after the war?
Sure. So after the war, he did go through a demilitarization process. He went back to the Fort Robinson Training Center, and they basically civilianized these dogs so that they would be able to function within just regular civilian circumstances. He was sent back to his family. Families did have the option of bringing the dog home to them, and they had to accept them no matter what the circumstance was. But Brownie had a wonderful temperament. He switched right back. He made the transition back from a fierce fighting sentry dog to that of a family dog. And he began to follow Orin, his young owner's mother, who was a cook at the home at the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King. She was a cook there. And he began to accompany her. He'd escort her to work every day. And then when she went in, then he'd make his rounds and visited all the veterans and really became quite beloved by the veterans and their families. And everyone was devastated when he was hit by a car and killed. But he did live out the remainder of his years really in service to man in just a different fashion. He served while he was overseas, and he served man when he came back. So I think when I learned of his story, I just thought it was the most endearing thing, that this animal just really his whole life was in service to people.
For sure. Now, of course, this is a fairly serious topic, and the book is for kids. What do you hope kids get from reading this?
I hope that they have a real understanding of the sacrifices that were made on the home front during World War II from the families, from the children. I hope that they also had a real appreciation for this canine hero who is from Wisconsin, who was buried here 75 years ago. 2024 marks the 75th anniversary of his passing and military funeral. But it pleased me just so much that the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, who published this book, felt the same way that I did, as far as that his story deserved to be preserved and shared in this fashion and in such a beautiful picture book format. So there are just so many things that I hope that children take away from this, but mostly just to have that appreciation of the sacrifice that was made.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly Nelson is the author of Brownie the War Dog. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll introduce you to some dance groups in Milwaukee, including senior movement groups that find health and community through dance. And we'll learn about an African dance company celebrating a milestone year. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.